Welcome to the Tuesday, May 10th, 2016, Reading Odysseys Reading and Discussion Group on Ovid's Metamorphoses, Books 1 and 2. So welcome to the Reading Odyssey. I just want to celebrate, this is our 11th year. We started in 2005. Wow, we have done more than 50 of these reading and discussion groups. We have actually been a first at a number of things. Before TEDx and other global events, we ran one of the very first virtual global events in 2009 when we celebrated the 150th anniversary of the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species. We put together a lecture series in collaboration with Harvard. Kendall Crolius ran all over the country for us setting up all these lectures.
Yes, I did.
And with leading evolutionary biologists around the world, and built a Facebook page, you remember that, with hundreds of thousands of fans. We got from zero to 250,000 members in 10 days. We did the same 2 years later for the 2,500-year anniversary of the Battle of Marathon. We have run close to 50 discussion groups, as I mentioned, on books from Homer, Herodotus, Thucydides, Plato, Aristotle, Euripides, Aeschylus, Aristophanes, Xenophon, Arrian, Cicero, Livy, Virgil, Lucretius, Shakespeare, Darwin, the Old Testament, and now Ovid. We begin our first reading group tonight of Ovid's Metamorphoses with this wonderful translation by our friend Stanley Lombardo, whose translation of Homer's Odyssey we also read, and if some of you remember, he came on and performed for us a portion of Homer's Odyssey with his drum. Do you guys remember that? And we have an alliance of some of the top scholars in the world who assist us, people like Professor Paul Cartledge from Cambridge University, independent scholar, creator, founder, publisher of the landmark series, Bob Strassler, Professor Jamie Rahm Bard, and others. Our mission is to inspire curiosity and lifelong learning and to help more adults understand that they too can read and discuss these wonderful works, and that it's pleasurable, gives perspective on the world, and allows all of us to participate in this 2,500-year-old conversation about all the important questions. So tonight we have a number of first-time readers with us, and we have veterans who've been doing it since 2005 or roundabout. Some of us have made a commitment to read and discuss these books for the rest of our lives. For those of you joining us for the first night, we hope after you participate in Ovid that you'll decide to join us on this journey. I'll be moderating tonight's session. We discovered a simple method for these discussion groups. We ask each reader to share a favorite passage. I will call on each of you and then moderate the discussion. This is a way into the text that is accessible, it's fun, and it gets at most of the important issues. A few rules of the road. Pronunciation. The fact is no one knows exactly how the Greeks and Romans pronounced the proper names we'll be using tonight. So just say it, however you think it should be said, and do not worry about it. There is no wrong way. I may cut you off. Don't take it personally. My job is to look after the group as a whole, as well as each of you as individuals. So I keep track of who's participating, and will sometimes cut someone off if I want to create a space for someone who has not yet heard from. When I call on you, say just where you are calling from and whether this is your first time. And if it is your first time, please share how you've heard about us. Okay. Any questions before we get started? All right. Let me just read off again who I have in attendance, and if I don't call your name at the end, let me know. So I've got Alan Davis, Kendall Crolius, Frank Rensler, Andre Stepanovic. Actually, I'm not sure if Andre's on the line yet. Bill Swizzle, Scott Thompson, Teresa Day, Josh Kirshner, Adam Davis, Nano Karma, Nancy Copens, Adam Davids, and first-time readers, Jonathan Allred, Jesse Jackson, actually, I think you've done this with us before, Scott Haber, Harry Keller, you have as well, and Stephen Bukidis. Have I missed anyone?
Yes, Stuart Alter.
Stuart Alter, wonderful, Stuart. Glad that you're with us. Is this your first time reading?
Not.
With us?
It's not.
I've been before.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you. Sorry about my bad memory. Great. Anyone else on the line? Okay. All right. So let's get started with Ovid. All right. So I am going to call on Kendall. Kendall, You have expressed on Facebook and over email your excitement to be reading Ovid with us. I also had the pleasure of seeing you really only just about a week ago. I can't believe it was only about a week ago.
And that's right.
So we're talking about introductions of introduction and books 1 and 2. Is there a passage you would like to share with us, Kendall?
Yeah.
If so, give us the page number first.
So it's page 24, line 651. This is right after Io's been transferred into a cow. So she was transferred into a glossy heifer. She was still stunning, even as a cow. I just loved it, and for me, there were lots of little moments like that of just, real charm and humor, and that one made me laugh out loud.
That's great. And what Kendall, what did you, so for everyone's benefit, Kendall is one of the founders of the Reading Odyssey and has been with us since day one. What was this like for you to read Ovid? Tell us more about your general impression.
I loved it, and I think I read bits and pieces in high school, but have never sort of tackled it beginning to end. I found it a very easy read, a fun read, lots of charm. And, one of the questions I had reading so many of these familiar stories was, and I haven't done the research on it yet, how many of these are ones, these kind of classic Greek and Roman myths that come to us, have come down to us because Ovid is the one who wrote them down. I haven't looked into that yet, but he's touched on so many familiar stories, and I've always been interested in how oral traditions kind of morph into and get frozen into literature, and I have the sense that he's responsible for us being able to be familiar with a lot of these stories.
Yes, and I seem to remember W.R. Johnson referring a little bit to the influence that Ovid obviously had, and we can certainly imagine he had a big influence. But that's a good question, and that's something I will happily ask Paul Cartledge and Jamie Rom, to our scholars, if they can give us an opinion over email before our next session. Cool. All right. Good.
Phil, before you move on, can I just say one other thing? I just want to welcome the new members who are joining us and just tell you, when I saw Phil a week ago, I met for the first time a woman who I had read a book with in this group, and we met for the first time last week, several years after reading this book, and flung our arms around each other. So, I hope that you find some fun friendships in this group as well.
Wonderful. Thank you, Kendall. Appreciate you helping to welcome the new members. It can be a little intimidating to do this, so we have to work hard to make them feel welcome. Great. All right, cool. Well, let me actually go ahead and call on first-time reader Jonathan Allred. Jonathan, tell us where you're calling from. I know you told me already, but share with the group how you heard about it. And share a passage with us.
I'm from Dallas, Texas, and I first heard about this group, I guess about a month ago, when I was calling the publishers of the Landmark History series and asking some questions about the next upcoming editions. And I had a conversation with one of the ladies that I spoke to, and she mentioned this group after we were kind of talking about interests. And so I decided to sign up for it. I have never read Ovid. I've read fragments and pieces of mostly the Golding translation in various books I've read that were collections of essays, for example. I'm familiar, obviously, with a lot of the stories, but so I've not tackled much Latin literature beyond pieces of the Aeneid that were in relation to some things I was studying in Homer previously. So this is exciting to me, and I guess you know, in the first book, I guess the thing that's probably the most interesting to me, obviously, is a sort of retelling of the four ages, but without the shoehorning in of the heroic age between the bronze and the iron that mm-hmm. you see and the sort of justification for the basically origin myths of most Greek communities and major families. They had to somehow shoehorn in a heroic past in between the decreasing quality of people between the bronze and the iron.
Yeah. Do you want to share a passage of the text with us, for example, of the decreasing quality?
Let me pull that up. I'm sorry. I'm reading from a Kindle, so it takes me a second to get it. The Kindle book is horribly formatted, so I'm sorry about that. But mainly, we're talking. I can't get to it fast enough without wasting everybody's time. It's going to take me 5 minutes to find it. So basically,
I'll come back to you. Why don't I do that? We'll come back to you for that passage. That's great, John. Good. And again, welcome. By the way, everyone, Jonathan won my heart when we were talking earlier when you said his favorite book. I don't know if you said your favorite book, but certainly one of the books you've done a lot of work on is Herodotus. We've Herodotus holds a dear place in our hearts.
I found the passage.
Oh, great. Okay, good.
Okay.
Tell us the page number and line number.
It is underneath the chapter called The Four Ages, and the line number would be line 90 of book one.
Okay, for those of you with the print book, we're talking about page 7, and it's sort of two-thirds of the way down the page under the subtitle Four Ages. So go ahead.
Would you just like me to read the passage?
Read what you'd like to share. Yeah.
Golden was the first age, a generation that cultivated trust and righteousness all on its own, without any laws, without fear or punishment. There were no threatening rules stamped out on bronze tablets, no crowds of plaintiffs cowering before judges. No one needed protection. Not a pine was cut from its native mountain to be launched on a maritime tour of the world. Mortal men knew no shores but their own. Steep trenches around cities were still in the future. There were no bronze bugles, no curved blaring horns, no helmets or swords. Without a military, a carefree people enjoyed a life of soft ease. The inviolate earth, untouched by hoes, still unwounded by plows, bore fruit all of its own. And content with food and unforced labor, men gathered arbutes, mountain strawberries, wild cherries, blackberries clinging to brambles, and acorns that fell from Jove's spreading oaks. Spring was eternal, and mild westerly breezes soft among flowers sown from no seed, even cultivated the soil soon bore crops, and fields unfallowed grew white with deep grain, rivers flowed with milk, and streams ran with nectar, and honey dripped tawny from green holm oak.
Wow, that is truly a great passage. I think one of the dimensions that I think it'd be important for us to reflect on is also the quality of the translation, the rhythm, the poetry, the off-rhyming, the sounds of this, as well as, of course, the content. And I think that passage one of my favorites is there were no bronze bugles, no curved blaring horns, no helmets or swords. I love the sound as well as the words there.
Cool. Can I add something?
Sure.
That particular four-age myth and its importance, I guess, in the ancient world as transmitted through Hesiod, the references in that to judges, which crooked judgments being such a key plaint, you know, inside of Hesiod's poetry, I find that it kind of an interesting echo that one of the key things that it mentions is that there was a time before judges. Because one of the chief complaints of Hesiod is crooked judgments and crooked people in the city.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. We have not read as a group Hesiod, and thank you for bringing that in. I think that's important.
Hey, well, this is Bill. One other point about that passage. is the myth of the hunter-gatherer is still with us.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take the first half of the passage, leave off the nectar and the mythology of society before, you know, in paradise where we were all hunter-gatherers, that's a myth that people still widely believe in.
And, you know, Guns, Germs, and Steel and other recent research has taught us that actually life before agriculture was in some ways better than life under agriculture for at least the first 11,000 years of agriculture for the majority of people who are having to till the field.
It's not a high standard for life being better.
No, it's true.
The point being, I'm not sure it was that great when we were hunter-gatherers either. It's just bad in different ways.
Yeah. Well, it's good. We'll leave that for now, Bill. So since you've spoken up, Bill's a longtime reader, founding member of Dream Odyssey. What would you like to share with us tonight?
Well, you know, I was going to share the stunning heifer. there was a follow-up on the same page when she tried to complain, she only mooed. which is also funny. And probably, I mean, it speaks to what I find one of the more interesting questions. That particular joke is probably, there's probably some misogyny in there about, you know, women complaining and sort of it being a relief that she could only moo. However, one of the things that I really am interested in, and that's maybe another question for the scholars, is the question of, you know, the number of rapes is, of course, stunning and disturbing. But the rapes do not seem to be presented in any kind of positive way, right? I mean, the rape scenes and these transformations are all a reflection of the sort of heedless cruelty and selfishness of the gods. So it's not like we're identifying with the rapists in these stories, I don't think. And I'm interested in what Romans would have, how they would have read all these episodes.
I mean, it seems as if the women are shaming themselves for being...
This is
Jesse, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Jesse.
I mean, I was struck not only by the stunning heifer, that not only is she so desirable even as a cow, but then also Laurel, and I think there were two others where, in order to avoid being raped, you know, women begged to be turned into vegetation, animals, stallions, whatever. And, you know, they're still beautiful, but, you know, they're also sort of shamed for being beautiful and have to, you know, change or escape or disappear in order to not be raped, which is pretty horrible.
Yeah, that's interesting. This is Nancy, and I had a similar view and thought, you know, the passage that I liked related to these things. I wouldn't say I liked it, actually. It was kind of alarming. But on page 47, this is Callisto. And when she stops at the pond where Diana is with the nymphs, and Diana beckons, and she's just been raped by Jupiter. And Diana beckons her in, saying, "There are no prying eyes here. Let's bathe in the flowing water." And then she blushes and sort of, you know, reveals herself. She's pregnant, and then she's shamed. She's cast out. And then Juno turns her into a bear, and then her son kills her. And I was thinking how much this, you know, there's so many conversations going on about, you know, sort of, you know, who's at fault, even with, like, how girls dress, and is it liberating to wear skimpy clothes, or are you being productive, and who's at fault if a woman is raped? And what I thought here, I don't know the name of the fellow who was just speaking about this, but I felt it was, like, terrible from a few, like, that they, you know, she happened to look good, so Jupiter desired her, and then next thing you know, Juno is turning her into an ugly animal.
No, I think that's important, Nancy, and I'll just add on page 46 in the Callisto, I mean, I was very struck by the Callisto story, as I'm guessing most of us were. And on page 46, the passage I wanted to share was, "She did struggle as much as a woman can. Had you seen it, Juno, you would have been kinder. but what man can a girl overcome, and who can overcome Job? So there's a recognition that she absolutely, you know, I mean, it's without question that this was against her will, yet she's blamed by both, you know, by both male and female deities, and cast out. And I think Bill's question of how would the Romans have viewed this, I think, is interesting. Someone wanted to jump in there.
I do want to jump in there, Phil. When you go to 49,
okay.
This is Frank. Okay. You know, it actually shows Juno, right, who's supposed to be, you know, Jupiter's wife and sister, the most powerful goddess. And she's basically on line 573 when she goes to complain to the old ocean and Great Thetis that, you know, she's not going to, you ask me why the queen of the celestial gods, am I here? No one would have replaced me in heaven. Am I alive if you don't see? When the sky gets dark, the constellation is set on high in spite of me? She's basically complaining that, you know, the woman that her husband raped, that she destroyed, now her husband put her back in heaven, and she says, I've been wronged also. It's just kind of like just shoving women down, whether she's a goddess or a nymph or, you know, mm-hmm. or anybody.
Well,
so I think it's
Nan.
A question of the culture.
This is yeah. Nan. But Juno yeah. has always been the jealous goddess. I mean, the Trojan War started because she was mad that she wasn't picked as the most beautiful by Paris. So Juno's always been jealous, and,
yeah.
you know, it's not a woman's fault that Jupiter went after her, but Juno's not doesn't care.
It's John. Can I say
hey,
something
John.
Real quick?
Sure, and then I want to call on someone we haven't heard from, but go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just be real brief. Another, you know, when you're reading Greek mythology, and I guess, it's, you know, it's Roman kind of transmission, a lot of times you're struck with the disgust from the gods, regardless of quote-unquote gender, for human beings. And a lot of that, what I think is alien to us, is that so much in the myth is about ritual, and that intent has very little meaning in their world. It is about what happens, the outcome. Even their religion is a mechanical religion. It is not so much devotion as the performance of certain rites. And I think that the outcome of you became pregnant is completely separate from the rationale for why that happened, whether it was rape or some type of consensual relationship. So I think that's very alien to us in our modern sensibility.
Yeah, that's a good point, John. I appreciate that. Let me call on another first-time reader here. Scott, would you like to add to the conversation we're having now, or would you like to share a different passage that struck you?
Yeah, this is Scott. I'm Scott Hyber from Baltimore. I think I'd like to shift if I could, only because that's what I have in front of me. So the passage that struck me the most is it's on page 35, line 93 to 95 or so, and it's Phoebus Apollo.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes.
If you really want assurance that you are my son, my anxiety should be all the assurance you need. I improved your father by a father's fear. And, you know, through the first two books, the gods have been so awful, and Phoebus Apollo in particular has been so despicable. And then I got to this passage, and it was sort of the first time where you began to feel some sympathy for Apollo, or perhaps, you know, he's humanized, if you will. You know, here he is acting and feeling like a father would. But then, of course, what he does right afterwards is give the equivalent of giving the 15-year-old the keys to the sports car and a bottle of Jack Daniels and sending him on his way. And I thought, you know, okay.
But what did he do? He promised he would fulfill any wish, right? His faith on us. So do you think
that's right?
Well, that was the one I wasn't
going to
grant you. Yeah.
Also, swearing against the Styx, I mean, it's an unviolable oath. I mean, so it wasn't so much a choice.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but you know, it's the one time I felt he was he's sharing something like a human quality, that of a father, but then he did what a father would not have done, or would not expect a father to do. So.
Yeah. It is an important and vulnerable moment, though, Scott, I think you're right to point out. And you can feel the sense of tragedy, you know, coming in his voice there.
Yeah. Again, it's kind of based on fallen ritual.
What's that?
You can't make that promise.
Yeah.
But it's also based on John's early point. It's all about fallen ritual, not really the circumstances.
Right. Right. And he did swear on Sturgeon, right? Where was that? Where did he swear?
The Stygian River.
The Stygian Marsh, yeah.
And this is John, just real quick on that, too. The consequence of violating that oath is, I think, 7 years of a near-death-like existence for a god. So for him to go through that means that their earth would be denied sunlight for 7 years. So the consequences of that oath add a layer of pathos, because it's really not something that could be easily denied.
Right. Right. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. This is just Elizabeth. I want you to know I just joined. Sorry to be so late.
Oh, Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you.
Have you just been hearing our conversation, or did you just...
I just heard the last, minute or two.
Okay. All right, good. Well, I'll call on you in a moment. So Scott, who's a first-time reader, was sharing with us page 35, line, whatever that is, 93 to 96, the pathos of Apollo and his son, Phaethon. And John was just sharing what the ramifications were of violating an oath that you have sworn to the River Styx or the Stygian Marsh.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is bad.
Okay. This is line 96?
Yeah, 993 on page 35, where the father is saying, you know, if you really want assurance that you're my son, my anxiety should be...
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I love the line, I approved your father by a father's fear. That is such great poetry.
Yeah,
it's a terrific line. All right, good. So let's see.
Can I ask a question?
Sure, go ahead. Who is that?
Is this John? Just a question. Is this Phoebus in this scene? Is this a syncretism between Apollo and Helios? Because I was reading this. I did not think that was actually Apollo. I thought it was the sun god that had a similar epithet attached to it. But I did not think that was actually Apollo in that scene.
Well, Phoebus Apollo is his full name, and I believe he's the Roman sort of aspect of the Greek god Apollo. But I believe he sort of I believe he also is sort of, when they refer to him as Phoebus, I believe, if I have this correct, others may understand it better than I do.
In the glossary of names, it says Phoebus is an epithet of Apollo.
Yeah. And I think, let's look into if that means he's essentially taken as he has, right?
Referring to his association with the sun. It's on page 485.
Okay. Thank you. There's a little. I'm not entirely sure if that means that Helios is completely, that he is essentially Helios, if he assumes Helios essentially, which is, I think, John's question. But I think
a lot of that happened in Hellenistic times.
Yeah. Of Phoebus Apollo, the god of the sun. Yeah, I think that is in fact, Jonathan. That's what I think. Yeah, we can confirm that. It's a good question. All right, good. And so I hope you all see that the idea here is not none of us, except to some degree John, I would say, are experts. We fumble along together here in trying to understand this text. And it's part of what makes this accessible. All right. So let me. So Josh, how about what's the topics that you like?
Well, I'm going to have to stay mostly in listen mode because I joined the group, this reading group, very late this time, Phil. And I only got the book yet.
Right.
They made it through the introduction. So I will absorb.
The introduction. Was there anything in the introduction that you wanted to call out?
No, I'll let others contribute for this call, and I will be on top of it for the next call.
Okay, all right. I'll call on you first next time. How about that? Harry, how about you?
Yes. The two parts that I like the best flowed, I thought, the poetry aspect of it. And the first part that struck me was on page 6, the top of page 6, which is probably line 32.
Okay.
Then the God who had sorted out this cosmic heap, whoever it was, and divided it into parts, first rolled the earth so it would not appear asymmetrical into the shape of a great sphere. And he goes on. I really like that whole part. But it struck me that he recognizes the earth as a sphere. You know, he's not one of the founding members of the Flat Earth Society. That kind of struck me. Then he continues on. I mean, that whole passage down to the bottom of the page, well, to the middle of the page, about line 60. I just love the way that rolled, the way he kept the poetry of that.
Yeah.
Translation's wonderful.
Yeah, it really is. And Andre, are you on the line with us? Have you called in late? No? Okay. Andre is our Latin scholar, Latin and Greek, and I guess he's not here with us tonight, but in a future discussion, I'll have him share with us a little bit of the Latin, because I think Lombardo has done a great translation here, but it's also really powerful to get a sense of the Latin about it. All right, well, good. Well, thank you. And I think the content of that is also interesting, right? The God who sorted this out, whoever it was, it goes along with Ovid's intent here, I think, to be poking some fun. Some sacred concepts in God, including the format of the epic itself. All right, cool. Thank you, Harry.
Hey, Phil.
Yeah. Who's that?
Hey, this is Stephen. Stephen from Philadelphia. And actually, that was part of my. Actually, I want to just add to what he was saying. That was part of my favorite piece as well. Starting with line 20, where it says, "Soft with hard and weightless with heavy." Some god or superior nature settled this conflict, splitting earth from heaven, sea from earth, and pure sky from the dense atmosphere. And he carved these out from the murky mass. In peaceful concord, he bound each in its place. The fiery, weightless energy of the convex sky shot to the zenith and made its home there. I just love how it's so visual and so rich in terms of, like, you almost can feel what is going on, like this pushing down of earth and this moving up the sky and this kind of putting this band in the middle. It's like it's, you know, the denser earth attracted the heavier elements. I just love that poetry and it's interesting because just to see almost the evolution of the creation, I thought it was very powerful language. It was really enjoyable.
Yeah. It's funny, this is Nancy. I had sort of a sense overall that it felt very cinematic. You know, it just felt so. And I don't know if it's the translation too, or not, but it just was, as he said, so visual.
Yeah, I agree, Nancy and Stephen. Thank you for that. I'm actually pulling out Lucretius. I meant to do this earlier, so it may not end up being as relevant. But let's see. Here's how Lucretius begins, and this is the translation by Martin Schmidt. Mother of Aeneas' people, delight of human beings and the gods, Venus, power of life, it is you who beneath the sky's sliding stars inspirit the ship-bearing sea and spirit the productive land. To you, every kind of living creature owes its conception and first glimpse of the sun's light. You, goddess, at your coming hush, at your coming, hush the winds and scatter the clouds. For you, the creative earth thrusts up fragrant flowers. For you, the smooth stretches of the ocean smile. And the sky, tranquil now, is flooded with effulgent light. It's remarkable, including because, of course, he calls on Venus. For the most part, Lucretius is really not, his perspective on the gods is that they're there, but they don't really have much to do with anything. And you get into it later. But it's such a gorgeous beginning. And, it's different from Ovid's, but also it's really beautiful and poetic. Cool. Well, thank you. All right, so let's see. Who else have we not yet heard from? Stuart, did I call on you yet?
No. Okay. On a passage, I did have one comment, though, back to Io and Europa and so on. I just find I'm sort of wondering what we make of the fact that these sort of victims of the gods become elements of nature. I sort of find that to be very interesting. The passage, though, that I wanted to share is the page.
Oh, hang on a second. What's going on? We're getting a beeping. Do you think somebody put us on hold? Oh, no. or is there an alien landing, perhaps?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. The beeping's gone. Okay. So, Stuart.
The passage is one. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Mercury, Hearse, and Aglaurus on page 56 in book two.
Thank you.
And
bringing us into book two. Thank you.
This point where, Mercury comes down to Earth and his vanity starting at 809. Okay. Hanging in midair, the son of Jupiter was assaulted by her beauty and burned with love the way a lead bullet shot by a Balearic
becomes. Oh, hang on a second. Just hang on a second, Stuart. We're somehow getting this beeping. I don't know what to do. It suggests to me that somebody has somehow put us on hold. And of course, if that's the case, we can't tell them.
That's what we can do about it.
To mute themselves. Here, what I can do is I can attempt to log into our web interface here. Hang on a second. Well, it's gone. So start reading.
It's so stopped.
Yeah.
Well, I.
Well, okay, I'll just go down to 8, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. He altered his course and headed from sky to earth without disguising himself, trusting his looks, although he did carefully touch them up, making sure his hair was smooth and his robe arranged so it would hang with all the gold border showing. I mean, just that element of before he comes down to earth, I found that to be amusing.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you. But did anyone want to call out the passage concerning envy and Nerva? And while you think about that, let me see if I can. First of all, what I'm going to do is I'm going to mute. I'm going to mute everyone. See if that fixed it. It did. Now, of course, I can't hear you, or you can't hear each other. And I can't hear you, so then it's a process of elimination here. How are we going to figure this out? Well, I'm going to unmute you all now. Let's see, unmute all. All right. Okay, you're all back, and now I'm going to selectively mute. Okay, it's not that one. Not that one. That one. That one. Sorry, guys. It either was that one or it stopped again for a moment. So let's see what happens. Did anyone want to call out the passage with Envy and Minerva? All right, I'm happy to if you like. I was very struck by that. If you go, it's pages 57 to 58, starting with line 850. I'll wait for you guys to find that. It's line 850. And it starts here. I'll read this. For the grimy and decaying house of envy, her cave was hidden deep in a sunless valley, impervious to wind, gloomy, hideously clean, ever a fire burning and eternally steeped in. When the formidable virago Minerva arrived, she stood. Oh, hang on a second. I will go back and see if I can figure out who this is. That one. I think I got it. Excellent.
Okay,
can great. Everyone hear me? Okay.
Yep.
Good. Yep. All right, so we'll go back. Formidable virago Minerva arrived. She stood outside the cave. She had no right to enter and pounded the doors with the butt of her spear. The doors flew open and revealed Envy, dining on viper meat, which kept up her venom. Minerva averted her eyes at the sight, but the other rose slowly up from the ground, leaving the carcasses of the snakes half-eaten, and came sluggishly forward. When she saw the beautiful goddess in her armored glory, she groaned and sighed, contracted her face, turned sickly pale, and shriveled up all over. Her eyes are askew, her teeth black and rotted, her breath green from bile and her tongue drips venom. She never smiles except at another's troubles. Her sleep is fruitless, a fitful, anxious vigil. Whew.
And harsh.
Okay. Interestingly, so Kendall and I were at the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting in Omaha, Nebraska, not this 10 days ago or so. And Charlie Munger, who's the vice chairman and Warren Buffett's business partner, said that many people think greed is the main problem in the business world, but he believes, in fact, that it's envy that drives many business leaders to make incredibly bad decisions. And here we are with Ovid describing envy for us in the worst possible way. And Munger says, among the problems with envy, it's one of the few sins that you derive absolutely no pleasure from. The person who is envious is only unhappy. There is nothing good that comes of it. I thought of him when I read this passage. I don't think I've seen a more eloquent description of envy in all of its worst aspects. All right. So let's see. Who else can I call on? Oh, no. I guess I didn't get it. All right. Here we are. Hang on, guys. I am going to try and... Well, maybe that was it. Hey, Kendall, are you on the line?
Yes, sorry. I had to unmute myself.
I had muted you before because I thought it was your line, but in case you were saying something when I was talking about Munger and Buffett, but it was not your line. I'm guessing that was you because it was a 203 area code. Okay. So this was a 718 area code that I just muted. So somebody in my borough here, Brooklyn, put us on hold. I'm going to have to find out who that was later. All right. Elizabeth. Are you ready to share with us your favorite?
I am ready. Oh, it's the one about when the earth is repeopled with rocks. Deucalion. Right. Oh yeah, right. Let me find it. I was turning to other people's passages. Okay, yeah. So I feel as I'm learning about myself by participating in these, because I always seem to like the same kind of passage. It's the passage that I think is, for some reason, I'm amused by. And it's when Pyrrha is told that she's supposed to throw her mother's bones behind her back, and
yes.
she's, you know, very, very distressed by that, and really can't do it. And then Deucalion says, this is the bottom of page 16.
Yeah, line 398, 400, something like that. Right
400 there. Something. And it yeah. continues on the top of 17. Either I'm mistaken, or since oracles are holy and never counsel evil, our great mother is earth, and stones in her soil are the bones we are told to throw behind our backs. And then so that's what they do. They decide it's a sort of a metaphorical interpretation, and that turns out to be the right interpretation. So I just am very amused, because for me it's like, you know, reasoning about the Bible. Well, it can't really mean that, because, you know, that wouldn't be right. So what it really must mean is, and it's just very amusing for me to see it in this context.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm just wondering, Phil, this is Frank, whether it's the same flood that's in the Bible, and it's just such a big part of the mythology of the whole Mediterranean basin that somehow got brought forward, and I was just kind of collecting the Roman version of it.
I don't know if anybody has any information about that.
Okay. This is Adam. I've just turned my page away from there, but there was in there a part, on the top of page 16, line about 377. By my father's arts, breathe life into molded clay. And that's the Adam mythology.
I think there were that idea of there having been a great flood in the past is a sort of ancient idea. And I have no doubt that there were floods, and, you know, they were... People talked about them for hundreds of years afterward.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. Scott Thompson, I don't think we've heard from you.
I'm sorry, this is just Nancy. I just want to just jump in on the first which is to note that the last ice age ended 10,000 years ago, and there were floods. And there are seashells to be found in the desert that are remnants of ancient seas. And so people understood that places they lived in once had water, and so they, I mean, there's a reason why the story of the flood exists in so many cultures, because there was a flood.
Yeah.
And you know, this is Elizabeth again. I mean, this is maybe just fantastic, but there were also Neanderthals, and they talk about giants or strange creatures, or, you know, and I think that, you know, there was a biological variety of humanoid that doesn't exist today, but did exist, and people talk about it.
You know that
this is John.
You have Neanderthal DNA. We all do.
Right.
The research has now shown that there actually was obviously some intermingling. John, go ahead.
I mean, even in Herodotus, where they talk about, you know, the formation of the Nile and the fossils.
Yeah.
I mean, and you think about the part of the Ovid, of the poem in the first couple of books, where they talk about the origin of amber. I mean, they were observant. They knew there's things in the world they had to explain. So the myths they created were actually fairly common sense, I think. I mean, you're up in a mountain, you see a fossilized bit of limestone with some seashells in it. Well, they don't understand the process of fossilization, but the most logical thing is, well, you know, there's a flood, and that's the remnant of it. And then you hear about it. There's someone, lady, I forget her name, she wrote a book about the legends of griffins and how the griffins and idea that they
come from dinosaur bones. Yeah.
Dinosaur bones in Mongolia and Central Asia.
Yeah.
And the bones.
Yeah, I have that book. It's a terrific book, actually.
Yeah. And the bones of Theseus that are mentioned in Herodotus are probably just mastodon bones found on one of the Cycladic islands. So, I mean, I think that's all real interesting.
Yeah.
I'm looking on my shelf now. I may not be able to place it quickly enough, but I can certainly send the reference to it later. It's a terrific book. It came out about 10 years ago, if I remember that correctly. And she traced a number of the Greek mythical creatures to various kinds of dinosaur bones. It was pretty cool. All right, good. Scott Thompson.
Yeah, hi. I'm on a Kindle also, but this is in book 2, line 800 is actually pretty close to something we looked at recently. It's
close
when
to the end,
Mercury
yeah.
goes to Athens.
Yeah, hang on just a second. Let's find the page numbers here. It would have been about page 55.
This is, could I ask a question? Are these books, were they Ovid's division?
I do not know the answer to that question.
It doesn't seem like a natural division.
I agree with you.
Two ends
really
in a really strange place, right?
Yeah.
I bet it's not. I mean, because any copy we have of this is way, way after Ovid.
Right.
Yeah, and we know that Herodotus' books were not his division. This is not uncommon. Good question. We can confirm that.
Do we know? I did not see anything in the introduction, which I was surprised. But do we know what year or years this was written in?
This was written after Augustus took reign, and after Augustus exiled Ovid to the Black Sea. I think it was somewhere between 13 and 20 A.D., something like that. I believe we can confirm it.
Yeah, I saw also, 8 A.D. somewhere.
Yeah, maybe it was
8. Also, folks, the book that everyone was referring to is called The First Fossil Hunters by Adrian Nayer.
Thank you, The First Fossil Hunters. That is it. Terrific text. I recommend
and
that you have it.
And one of the most fascinating references was that if you stood a mastodon bone up like a human, there's an eye socket and a hole in the skull, like
the cyclops.
And that yeah. might be the cyclops. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Very great. Good. Can you email that around, Nancy?
Sure.
Or just email it to me. Great. Okay. So Scott, line 800, page 56.
Yeah, so it's there. He's at the festival of Pallas, and virgin girls were bearing to the goddess temple mystic flower wreath baskets balanced on their heads. The winged god saw them on their way back and glided over to them, not in a straight line, but in a long spiral, like a vulture that has spotted entrails on an altar. And afraid of the priest still crowded around the victim, flies in circles and hovers greedily over his hoped-for prey, which is sort of a stunning image to identify Mercury with a vulture. But I thought it worked on another level as well, in that his symbol is the, I can't pronounce this right, caduceus, the stick with the snakes twined around it.
Mm-hmm.
And the motion that he's making around the line of the girls is almost that same shape, which I thought was just an artistic touch on Ovid's part.
Nice addition to that. Thank you, God. See, isn't this so cool? Everyone sees something a little bit different. Love that. What did you think in general about the text, Scott?
I mean, like everybody, the volume of rapes is stunning and almost numbing. And it's jumping just in the first couple books.
Right.
I actually, somebody earlier on the call talked about how appalling Apollo was. I didn't think he was nearly as bad as Zeus. I thought there was an interesting contrast between his attack on Daphne, which was certainly not admirable, followed by Jupiter's attack on Io, which seemed so much worse.
Yeah.
I thought he was. I mean, in general, the introduction, was making the point of the identification of the drawing between Augustus and Jupiter. And to the extent that's true, I think he really is tearing down Jupiter in these first two books.
Yeah. So I think, let's just pause for a moment because someone asked earlier about the date. I meant to do this at the beginning. Let's just remind ourselves of the context in which this is being written. So Ovid was born, you know, we've spent the last couple of years reading and studying the period around the fall of the Republic and the beginning of the Roman Empire under Augustus, right? And so this is in that same period of time. So, you know, Ovid was born, actually I don't have the notes right in front of me, but I think he was born right at the beginning of the breakdown, perhaps right around the time, if I have that right, of Caesar first. I think he was born around the time of Caesar's wars in Gaul, if I remember that correctly.
It's 43 BCE.
Yeah, yep, that's it. And then, you know, he comes from the equestrian class. He's kind of educated to become a politician, decides not to go in that direction, becomes a poet, writes a bunch of different kinds of poetry, and then, you know, kind of writes some poetry that pokes fun at morals and plays with seduction and affairs and love and kind of pisses off Augustus, who, after he takes control, decides that he would try to impose a moral code, and Augustus exiles him. But it's this same moment that we've been studying Cicero, that we've been studying, Virgil writing the Aeneid, of course, we didn't study Livy's writings of this period, but we studied the earlier formation and got a sense of the Carthaginian wars that, you know, gave such identity to the Republic. So here we are. So that's the moment that we're in. And Scott's pointing out that in the introduction, Johnson points out that, you know, there's a lot of that Ovid is playing with parallels between Jupiter and Augustus. And there's actually a reference to, at the very beginning, about when Jupiter brings the gods together, when he's deciding to basically, you know, kill all the humans, that the gods assemble, and the Milky Way is like the Palatine of Rome, which is where the senators and the rulers live, and you know, making the self-conscious comparison there, which will come up much later again. So just a reminder about that. That's the time frame that we're... Okay, good. All right, we're at 9 o'clock. I want to do a few more minutes. In particular, I want to see who we have not heard from yet. I think, Alan, did we hear from you?
No, you haven't.
Okay. I apologize.
That's all right. Let me segue off.
We have not heard from you either. Yeah. So let's hear from Alan and Teresa, and there may be a few others. Okay, go ahead.
Segue off of the... comments about Augustus. Messages that I reflected on that are really in two spots. One is on the top of page 11. And this is just after Jupiter has said, I have to destroy the human race. God knows why, but that's what he pronounces. And the gods all trembled and jealously demanded the traitor's head. So it was when all disloyal were mad to blot out Rome with Caesar's blood, and the human race was stunned with fear of Roman, and the whole world shuddered. The loyalty of your subjects, Augustus, pleases you no less than Jove was pleased. With words and gesture he stilled the crowd, and when the clamor had been suppressed by his royal gravitas, Jove once more broke the silence, saying, da 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 da. Then it follows on, if you go to line 252 on page 12. So Jupiter, as Augustus has made the pronouncement, this is what we're going to do. And then it's interesting how he brings in the humanity of the gods. He says, some of the gods voiced their approval and even goaded him on, while others play-acted with their silent consent. But they all winced on the inside at the impending loss of the human race and wondered out loud, what would the world be without men? Who would bring incense to their altars? So
Sorry, did I cut you off? Do you want
to say something more? All I was to say is that the gods are playing up to Zeus, and their concern is not with the human race, but with who's going to pay them homage.
Yeah. A bit of a not so veiled criticism, I think, on Ovid's part. Cool. All right. Teresa. Are you there, Teresa?
Hi, I was on mute, sorry. So I was really moved by the beauty of the translation. I remember reading Ovid in college and not being drawn into the text as I was with this, especially in his descriptions of nature, and we covered a lot of that already. One other passage that I liked, and I guess I saw Apollo and Daphne a little bit different, mainly because Apollo was a victim of Cupid, being love-struck and chasing after Daphne. But if you go to page 22, and it's line 54 starting there, I just thought this was a really great passage. It says, Apollo, so this is after line 584.
Okay, great.
Okay, and so Apollo is chasing after her, expressing his love to her, and she's terrified of him, and she, you know, prays to her father to turn her or transform her so that she won't be caught by him. And so she's turned into a tree, and it says, Apollo still loved her, and pressing his hand against her trunk, he felt her heart quivering under the new bark. He embraced her limbs with his own arms, and he kissed the wood, but even the wood shrank from his kisses. The god said to her, since you can't be my bride, you will be my tree. My hair will be wreathed with you, laurel, and you will crown my quiver and lyre. You will accompany the Roman generals when joyful voices ring out their triumphs and their long parades wind beneath the Capitol. You will ornament Augustus's doorposts, a faithful guardian standing watch over the oak leaves between them. And just as my head with its unshorn hair is forever young, you will always wear beautiful undying leaves. I just thought it was a really beautiful passage, despite the circumstances.
Yeah.
And it goes along with his description of nature. I just felt like the language is so beautiful when he's describing nature, and I really think that that's attributed to the Lombardo translation.
Yeah. Oh, good. Well, I'm glad the translation. Yeah, go ahead. Who was that? Somebody was jumping in. No? Okay. All right. Has anyone, have I missed anybody?
Hey, Phil, it's Jesse.
Yes, Jesse. Ah, we didn't hear from you.
So I just, since we're close to ending, yeah. Actually going back to the beginning on page 7,
yeah.
Line somewhere around maybe 86 or so, two things about this. So the first thing is on these couple of pages, they refer to God with about, I think, 7 different names. He's the God, he's the God ordained, he's the world fabricator, he's the deity, and then the one I love is master artisan in this paragraph. And the line I like is, he gave to humans an upturned face and told them to lift their eyes to the stars. And I just love that because it's such an optimistic
great
moment preceding that golden age and, you know, before everything just turns to shit and, you know, everyone starts being jealous and wanting to kill each other. So I love that moment.
That I marked down Jesse too. It's one of my favorite passages, actually. And I, that line, told them to lift their eyes to the stars. It's a great line. Great line. It's gorgeous. Well, thank you. Well, I think that that's a good way for us to close with our eyes upturned on our upturned face, lifted to the stars. Thank you for starting Ovid with us. We had several new readers tonight with us. Welcome again. As we go through this book, we will start to develop more of a rhythm. We will get to know each other more. We'll start to get to, some of the additional unimportant issues that the text raises, whether it be the beauty of the language, the sound, musicality of the poetry, or the intent of the words. Are there any final comments or questions?
I have a question, and this goes to the translation, so maybe you can ask Andre. But when they mentioned the Milky Way,
did they
call it the Milky Way? Like, what is the actual translation translate to? Or is it the Milky Way because that's what we know?
Andre, you're with us, my friend.
Yes, I've been on, but I've just been quiet. I will look at that, and I can't find it right at the moment, but they could very well have called it that, because I don't remember off the top of my head.
It's page 10, line 173, I believe.
173. Okay, that'll help. I'll look at it real quick. Let me look at the Latin 173.
Yeah,
173.
Yeah,
173. Okay, here we go.
Do you mind reading the Latin so we can hear it?
Let's see. Ah, here we are. Okay. Let me see. Okay. Est via sublimis. There's a high, like a very, very high road, you know, or way, they said. Kylo Manifesta Sereno, Lactea Nomen Habet. It has the name of the Milky Way. I mean, Lactea is lactose, right?
Oh,
so
it's
a perfect translation. Lactea Nomen Habet Candor in Notabilis Ipso. It's called the Milky Way, famed for its shining whiteness. So I think it's good. Did it come from Ovid? Probably he got it from the Greeks, who used a word similar to that to describe the stars. You know, they give us all those great words like nebula and stuff like that. So, and who knows where they got it from? Could be the Babylonians or the Egyptians, or you know, those people were into the stars. So, yeah, good question.
Hey, Andre.
Yeah.
Since you're with us. Talk to us a little bit about your either end us with a passage that you love, or just talk to us a little bit about why you love Ovid.
I'll send a few little quotes from some of the stories, like Daphne and Apollo, and some of the other ones. But there are moments. I mean, you can pick almost any line, and if you look at the meter. For instance, Daphne and Apollo, when he's just about to catch her, and there's that nice little simile of the hound chasing the rabbit or something, and he's just about to snatch the rabbit in his jaws, you know, and so on. The meter speeds up. And so it's just like in the movies when the soundtrack's going dun, 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 like that, you know, the dactyls are just flying. And it's amazing. I mean, it's that kind of stuff that you can get in the Latin as well. And then there's some, and so I'll post that, and then I'll post another great example of like word order, where Deucalion and Pyrrha are throwing rocks behind their back, and literally the words are, you know, show that they're throwing rocks behind their back because the word order is reversed, you know, or something like that. It's it's kind of cool, those kind of things. So.
That's terrific. Well, that's before you joined us, I had mentioned that I was hoping you would share with us some of the Latin that will help us. Deepen our understanding of the power.
Yeah, I'm one of the Latin consultants for this, you know, for this round here. Just kidding.
Exactly. Well, good. Thank you, everyone. And again, welcome.
Thank you,
Joe. And welcome back, veterans. So excited to be tackling Ovid with you. Thank you, Frank. And Hope you have a good month. We will meet again in June, and we'll keep going as we metamorphosize ourselves to understand this great text.
Thanks, all.
All right.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Take care.
Bye.